welcome you and our observers who are here. There was one observer who had made a request to want to dub this session. I sought the advice and I was told that portfolio committees are open to the public before somebody runs to court. So you are allowed, Chief. We have an agenda in front of us with two items. Today we had organized specifically for the main item, the briefing by the department on the CCW. Ambassador Gumbi from DICO is here with Mr. Hooper, who Deputy Minister's end day, a title of being an ambassador of DICO in the parliament. Mr. Hooper is entered from the committee member. That's going to be the main item. The second item which we will consider looks into the, it's a follow-up on last week, it's a matter arising on how to take forward the TTCA. Those are the main items. We're not going to go into the minutes today. We will deal with them next week. So we'll just shoot straight into the presentations. I have only those two items unless there's any other thing, agent. Yes. Sorry, dear.
Honorable Sunduza is just delayed. She will be here in 15, 20 minutes.
Thank you, member. We do have a list of written apologies from. We do have a list of written apologies from Honourable Dudley from COPE.
Thank you very much.
No, she's from ACDP. She's from ACDP. My apologies. Dr. Korenoff, Honorable Dr. Korenoff from the ANC, Honorable Manana, those are the written apologies which we will accept. We will note the verbal apology. And unless there's any other issue, there's a request by IDASA, which we will discuss in the management with them immediately after this meeting. And then we will process it along those lines. Immediately after this meeting, I will have a short session with the management with them. Unless, there's no other item. And we're not going to vote on other prisoners, Konyan. We're not going to vote. Because when you hear other people are not there, I don't know what's going on. Welcome, Deputy Minister, to this meeting. We know that your schedule as ministers, especially in international relations, given the nature of the very ministry, you spend most of your time outside. But we know that from time to time, when you are available, you're able to be part of this committee, especially when the department is making some presentations. You're welcome to the committee. Of course, as a representative of the ministry and the department. Without much ado, Let me hand over to Ambassador Gumbi to lead us on the basis of the request which was made last week which is going to be a briefing on the CCW. Ambassador Gum.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Member of Parliament, Mr. Mansi. Honorable Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Honorable Members of Parliament and Observers. I would like to preface my presentation with two comments. The first one is that the convention that we are looking at today is about restrictions on types of weapons to be used in armed conflicts. I want to emphasize that this is not a new issue in the conduct of armed conflict. It is an old exercise which dates back to ancient civilizations, the Greeks, for an example, and the Romans restricted the use of poison or poisoned weapons. In ancient Hindu laws, poisoned weapons were
Honorable members, those who do not have the copies of the slides, they are available here.
Poisoned weapons, as well as burning arrows, were restricted in armed conflicts. So what we are dealing with is basically an old issue that seeks to emphasize the humanitarian aspect during the conduct of armed conflict. Secondly, I would like to point out that the way the convention is structured reflects the dilemma that the international community has always faced vis-à-vis the right to self-defense and the types of weapons to use in the practical realization of this right during armed conflicts. That is why the convention has a general framework that is followed by protocols. The protocols tend to get into more detail on what is to be restricted and what is to be prohibited. But also let me hasten that as a usual practice in such international legal instruments, some of these measures tend to be voluntary, which puts into sharp contradiction the principle of the right to self-defense. So we must have this in mind as we proceed with the presentation. That said, the presentation will cover basically the following issues: background to the CCW, its significance, South African participation in the activities of the CCW, and why are we here, and why do we want to South Africa to consent to the amendments, and what do those amendments entail. As background to the CCW, I would like to first highlight the fact that This is an international legal instrument that seeks to place restrictions on weapons that can be excessively injurious or have indiscriminate effects during armed conflicts. And the CCW has general clauses which are covered in the framework, as well as protocols. The protocols basically cover non-detectable fragments, and this protocol is more of a prohibitive nature. Second protocol is on mines, booby traps, and other devices, and it is of a restrictive nature. The third one is on incendiary weapons, again of a restrictive nature. Fourth one, blinding laser weapons, which is prohibitive in character. And the fifth one on explosive remnants of war, which is a post-conflict remedial measure. That said, the general clauses which I said are widely referred to as the Framework Convention have been subscribed to by 112 states. And the other protocols, the first one on non-detectable fragments by 110 countries, the one on mines, booby traps, and other devices by 94 state parties, the incendiary weapons protocol by 106 countries, blinding laser weapons, 97 countries, explosive remnants of war by 68 countries, and amendment to Article 1 of the framework by 74 countries. I am giving you the statistics to try and illustrate the popularity of this instrument and also to show that the international community is deeply committed to its full implementation. These numbers, if they are dissected further, will show that to a large extent they consist of developing countries which are widely affected by some of these scares. What then is the significance of the CCW? It is the only legally binding international arms control measure that either prohibits or restricts the use of a range of diverse conventional weapons. This again, the element of prohibiting and restricting, reflects the dilemma that the international community has with regard to the principles of the right to self-defense vis-a-vis the use of certain types of weapons in during armed conflicts. Prohibition and restriction are two distinct terms that do not necessarily mean the same, but taken in large, they are less emphatic than a total ban, which is in the case with biological and chemical weapons. And these are the only two weapons of mass destruction that are completely banned, whereas nuclear weapons the weapon of mass destruction and small arms and light weapons are prohibited and or restricted, which means they can be used. Secondly, the fact that the CCW addresses weapons deemed to be excessively injurious or to have indiscriminate effects makes the CCW an important instrument of international humanitarian law. The protocols that I alluded to, if you closely examine them, you'll realize the humanitarian aspect that is associated with them, more especially the explosive remnants of war, which deals with the removal of ordnance after armed conflict. Thirdly, the CCW is a good attempt to regulate, in certain cases, the transfer of specific conventional weapons, and in this way it distinguishes the CCW not only as a non-proliferation measure, but also as an arms control tool. Now, in the jargon of arms control, we have three important aspects: ban, transfer, which is non-proliferation, and stockpiling. Non-proliferation is an important measure in the sense that it limits the distribution of categories of weapons, which then helps to keep them in the hands of a few and therefore to make the process of verification simpler. But the flip side of that is that this tends to create aspiration in those that do not possess those weapons, because they feel that there is discrimination. Why should a few possess them and the others not? A typical thing to illustrate the case is the issue of nuclear weapons. There is an outcry that why should others possess and others not? Therefore, that's where the question of non-proliferation comes in very sharply. That said, Honorable OMPs, I would now like to look at South Africa's involvement in the activities of the CCW. South Africa started to get involved in the activities of the CCW on 13 September 1995, when it deposited its instrument of accession to the convention. Soon thereafter, in March 1996, it became a state party to the convention. The role players involved in the activities of the CCW are the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. The involvement of this department is basically along the following lines. Firstly, to ensure that South Africa implements its treaty obligations. Secondly, to ensure that South Africa participates in the deliberative processes in the context of the CCW, so that we can monitor what is happening there. Thirdly, to ensure that South Africa's interests are promoted and protected in relation to activities of the CCW, as well as to provide policy advice on issues related to CCW. The second significant entity is the Department of Defense and Veteran Affairs. The major role of this department is to ensure that restricted types of weapons covered in the CCW are not used in armed conflicts by military personnel of the Republic of South Africa. Third entity is civil society, which is very vocal and active, more especially on the question of mines and the explosive remnants of war. I must here emphasize that in general, when you look at conventions related to small arms and light weapons, you will realize that civil society has played a very prominent role in the sense that they have propagated full implementation of these treaties, where state parties, because of the dilemma I alluded to earlier on, have been reluctant to implement certain things. Civil society, you'll find that, has always played an active role. We are aware of the role that people like the late Princess Diana played on mines, and that even civil society continues to play now on mines. Demining processes are largely taken through civil society organizations throughout internationally. And treaty obligations, civil society continues to put pressure on governments to be active in this regard and honor their treaty obligations. Then why do we have, honorable MPs, have to participate in CCW activities? Firstly, I think that we'll all agree that CCW contributes in creating a conducive environment for stability to prosper. Secondly, the CCW contributes to the maintenance of international peace and stability, as well as security. As a type of weapon system regulation, it contributes to the maintenance of international peace and security, because we are all aware of the role that weapons have played in contemporary international relations to foster instability and threaten peace and security the world over, and even in regions of the world. And the CCW is a useful measure in limiting and alleviating the suffering caused by excessively injurious weapons. I would now like to highlight, honorable MPs, the forms of South African participation in CCW activities. In our game, we talk of national interests. No friends and nothing else but national interests. So we are there to promote and protect South Africa's interests in the CCW. And that is the first and foremost thing. Secondly, were there to ensure that there is national implementation of South Africa's treaty obligations in the context of the CCW. Thirdly, is to ensure that we utilize the CCW as a platform to advance our foreign policy objectives on disarmament, non-proliferation, and arms control. And that we achieve the promotion of the objectives of the CCW in order to gain stability, more especially in post-conflict reconstruction. That said, I would now like to point out what therefore has to be done. I would like to recall that as we were here the last time, we are again here to prevail upon members of Parliament in order to obtain South Africa's acceptance, approval of amendments that have to be undertaken in the context of Article 1 of the CCW and Protocol 5 of the CCW. We need your permission to be bound by these two amendments. What then do these amendments entail? Article 1 is about making the CCW applicable to conflicts of a non-international nature. What do we mean by that? In looking at the present epoch we're in, you will realize that conflicts have transformed in a very fundamental nature. Previously, they used to be between states. They used to take a form, a more defined form, where participants could be clearly defined as armed personnel of the states involved in the conflict. But now that has changed. Conflicts have increasingly become intrastate in nature, and they no longer necessarily involve armed personnel, like in the form of military personnel, but they involve all kinds of interest groups. You have groups that would be motivated to participate in a conflict because they feel that, for an example, national resources are not equitably distributed. Case in mind here is Nigeria, where in the oil delta there are groups that feel they are not benefiting from the oil. Therefore, they should, in an armed way, try to reconfigure the distribution of that wealth. So, these conflicts, because they have changed, they are no longer necessarily defined as international, because if it was state to state, would describe that as international. But now, this has changed, to be even more intra-incarnate. And I must say that this is largely prevalent in Africa. So, Article 1 seeks to make sure that this applies to conflicts in their entirety and in a comprehensive manner. And I must say that this is a very welcome aspect of the CCW because it addresses the plight of civilians, it addresses the plight of humanitarian workers during armed conflicts and in post-conflict reconstruction. And then we have Protocol 5, which, as I had pointed earlier on, deals with explosive remnants of war, and therefore it is widely regarded as a post-conflict remedial measure. Again, this relates largely to the African continent and has a direct implication on conflicts on the continent and efforts to try and put back the continent back on its feet, more especially after conflicts. As I stated, the protocol deals mainly with the clearance, removal, disposal and destruction of munitions following the cessation of active hostilities, the retention and transmission of information, the protection of civilians and humanitarian missions, and international cooperation and assistance. In addition to this, there are technical and preventive measures to the protocol that are contained in its annex. Honorable MPs, I must say that the issue of partnerships in the context of explosive remnants of war is very important because, as I had mentioned, and as we are aware, the African continent does not have resources to deal with these explosive remnants of war after conflict situations. Therefore, most of the time, we have to actively participate in building partnerships with the North to try and get financial and other resources for all the activities related to explosive remnants of war, like clearance, removal, disposal, and destruction of munitions. In this context, we also not look only at North-South cooperation, but we also try to encourage South-South cooperation, where countries that have advanced technologies in the South are encouraged to join hands so that we deal effectively with these explosive remnants of war, so that there can be successful reconstruction after conflict situations. That said, Excellencies, sorry for that. Why do we have to consent as a country to the amendments to Article 1 and Protocol 5? The first reason is that this would demonstrate South Africa's commitment to promote international peace and security. And I think this is the measure political significance of the CCW and a major implication, political implication of the consent that we are seeking. Secondly, this would limit and alleviate the suffering caused by war and armed conflict. And I think this is an interest that all of us as South Africans, irrespective of our backgrounds, political convictions, or whatsoever, are committed to. Thirdly, I think this would demonstrate South Africa's commitment to execute its responsibility to implement international humanitarian law and arms control policies. The primary goal of South Africa's policy on disarmament, non-proliferation, and arms control is also to reinforce and promote South Africa as a responsible producer, possessor, and trader of defense-related products and advanced technologies in the categories of weapons of mass destruction, missiles, and small arms and light weapons. Therefore, if we were to consent, we would have achieved this goal and also have been in conformity with the cabinet decision of August 1994. That said, I would like to highlight it that all the recommended action would have no organizational implications to the structures or capabilities required in respect of the amendment to Article 1 of the Treaty and Protocol 5. And that there would also be no financial implications other than contributions to meeting, the servicing of meetings of the state parties in Geneva, for which South Africa's assessed cost is approximately $1,000 per annum. These costs are covered by DICO and are already being made by the department as South Africa attends meetings as an observer until we consent to Article 1 and Protocol 5. Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Minister, Honorable MPs, I end my presentation there. As I had stated, I was here before. I hope I'm here again for the last time. If I have to be here again, let it be on a different issue. I don't want to start dreaming this, but I'd like to prevail on the honorables that we consent. I thank you.
Thanks, Ambassador Kumbi. Straightforward. Clear. So we'll keep it simple and straight. That kiss. Where's the kiss party, by the way? What happened to it? Who's funding them? Well, they are there for elections, and after that they are gone. That's a by the way. Thank you very much, Ambassador. Honorable members, this is open for questions, comments, and discussion. not just for the sake of discussing, but if there are issues you feel strong we have to raise. Can I take the hand?
Can I just, since I'm leaving, can I ask the first question?
Okay. The Deputy Minister, and then Honorable Ngonyama, Honorable Mubu, you're the last, Honorable Magama. No. You'll follow Honorable Mubu, you'll be the last, Honorable Mkhalapa, you'll be the last, Sundusa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've got another meeting at 11, so I have to leave. So sorry about that. But I just wanted to know, you said about weapons that are restricted and prohibited. Now you said even if they are prohibited, it could be used. Now what is the real difference? Why you say some are restricted and some are prohibited? Why is it that if it is prohibited, that it still could be used under certain circumstances?
Thanks, Chief. So is the line follows. I can see you are revived, Honorable Thomas, now. You're strong, I can see that.
Thank you, Chair. I think the Deputy Minister has covered me on the first one. The second one with me is just a question of concepts non-detectable. In practical terms, and in simple terms, what do I mean by that? And incendiary, the last one is, I think it's on Article 5. When we say the emphasis is on post-conflict remedial measures, in practical terms, in terms of the program, what is expected? What do you mean by that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Personally, I think in terms of the content of the presentation and what Ambassador has put forward to us and what he wants us to do, personally, I feel that South Africa has a responsibility to say to this. There's really not too much that they're asking for from us. Basically, just to say, do we agree with this amendment or not, and which is, I think, in the best interest of our country that we do this. But just one clarification, two clarifications. When you say prohibited and restricted, what the Deputy Minister referred to, is there an element of voluntary use of this weapon, those so-called prohibited and restricted? And if they are prohibited and restricted, who can control who uses those weapons? The second part, question is, when you say that the CCW really is applicable to non-international conflicts, particularly those that happen in intra, within the state like Nigeria, that you gave an example of, how is it possible in a country, in a situation where there's no rules of engagement? I mean, in a war like that, there's really no, and sometimes don't even see the enemy, in terms of the national army confronting a rebel group, like, there are no rules. So how do you regulate that after the conflict, those rebels can actually even be convinced to provide information where they are hiding those the remnants of war? Thank you, Chair.
Karal.
Yes, Lalo Ngos. Chair, thank Deputy Minister for the question. My first question is, why is there this discrepancy, of ratification or accession by countries on the different protocols? I mean, you have amendments to Article 1, only 74 countries. The Framework Convention, why is it more popular than, so why these varying degrees of ratification? And is participation in the CCW voluntary, and other sanctions. If countries transgress, are there any, you know, repercussions for such countries outside of the, in terms of, in the context of the CCW, outside of, you know, your normal condemnations and vetoes in the Security Council. And then the you raised or you observed that on some of these protocols, it's primarily developing countries. Why are the developed nations so slow? And then lastly, Chair, and I'll come back, Chair, if I missed it here somewhere, but it's fine, thanks.
I'll just hold, Chief. Just in the interest of the Deputy Minister's complete, can we just start getting the response? I'll come on the on your earlier suggestion of a second bite. Chief, you want to start responding?
Thank you. Restriction versus prohibition. I'm not a lawyer. Neither am I a linguist. Lawyers and linguists have a way of trying to find differences between these terms. But for me, in practical terms, when you say you prohibit or you restrict, it means one and the same thing in terms of the practice. But definitely, lawyers and linguists will find a difference between the two. And I must say, this is one issue which always bogs us down in these negotiations. Time to no end. Whenever there are international conferences, you find that language becomes a very important issue. Sometimes we are talking past each other because we agree to disagree what something obviously means. Would say a bottle is a vessel that can contain water instead of saying it's a bottle, you know. So why all these terms? It's because states would like to hide behind some of these things. They would tell you that if you prohibit, it doesn't carry the same meaning like when you restrict. Restrict means I can use, but in a limited way. But when you prohibit, it means I cannot use. But then, we as South Africa always argue, why don't you ban? Because if you ban, you are achieving the complete non-use of that. Then they will say, you know, if you prohibit, then you can evoke Article 55 of the United Nations Charter, the right to self-defense. So those things always come in, and those conflicts of interest. And the fact that small arms and light weapons are legitimate, you have the right to possess them, because if you are attacked, you have to rebut the attack. then this also complicates the equation more. Now, I hope this answers not only the Honorable Deputy Minister, but also the question raised by Honorable Mubu. Now, on the issue of non-detectable and incendiary, militarist practitioners would be better placed to define what is all this about. But put in simple terms, if you place weapons, you should, in a way, alert and mark that there are, this area is mined. That's why when you place mines, normally in the old days, you would plow around the area to show that the ground has been tampered with. People should therefore be careful, more especially the civilians. But it so happened later that when mines are placed, actually people camouflage them. So that's where the issue of detectability comes in, that these things should be detectable, so that in post-conflict situations, you should be able to lift them up and take them away. Incendiary. That, to be honest, is very technical. I wouldn't say I'm competent enough to describe it in a very simple terms. You know, it's got all its military connotations. They've got all kinds of, you know, markers they use to say this is incendiary and non-incendiary. It's beyond my scope, basically, and I wouldn't like to say and lie here and say I can best define it. Now, what do we mean by conflict, post-conflict remedial measures? Now, like I said, let's put this into context a bit. You'll find that, as I said, most conflicts now have really transformed in a very, very fundamental nature. Most challenges tend to lie after the conflict situation. Inasmuch as during war, there could be no rule of law whatsoever, which Mr. Honorable Mubu referred to. But soon after the post-conflict situation, parties to the conflict would have agreed that, look here, we have battered each other sufficiently. Let us now start doing something, stop this nonsense, and get back to normal life. So, the remedial part comes in there. And that's where now you have to start looking at what do you do to make sure that you emerge of the conflict situation into a post-conflict one where you'll have reconstruction, rebuilding, and basically putting back normal life back on track. That's what we basically mean, that it is a post-conflict remedial measure. The very removal of mines, the clearance of munitions and all that, enables the people to go back, for an example, to till the land and therefore start making a living. That is remedial, and that addresses a post-conflict situation where now people seek to get back to a normal life. In part, I think I've answered Honorable Mubu's questions on restriction and prohibition when I answered the question of Honorable Minister, and also of how do you regulate after a conflict situation. Coming to the question of Honorable Member of Parliament Magama, I'd like to say that, as I pointed out in my presentation, right from the beginning, that the issue that we always have to keep at the back of our mind is that in this game, it is the protection of interests, promotion and protection of interests. How states subscribe to an issue reflects how they feel their national interests will be promoted and protected by the said international legal instrument. Article 1, which relates to expanding the scope of the application of the treaty, has a very direct implication to the right of a country to self-defense, if you look at it carefully. You might have a group which a country considers to be rebels, and you want to deal with those rebels with your armed forces. So, you'd have to take into account, how far would I be violating Article 1? That's why you have countries a bit reluctant to subscribe to Article 1. Because they want to leave themselves that leeway to deal with internal instability in case it arises, and not to be brought in front of any legal court to say we have transgressed this and this international instrument. So again, it's national interest. But not necessarily to say the CCW as a framework is more popular, but to say that they are ready to be bound, but to a limited extent. But on the flip side too, you can say that because the framework is general clauses, therefore they are comfortable with that, because it wouldn't go too deep in affecting the extent to which they would have their sovereign right to promote and protect their national interests. Issue of voluntarism. We have international legal instruments to try and establish norms and best practices. But at the end of the day, all said and done, we know that one of the weaknesses of international public law is that at the end of the day, you cannot drag a country to a court and say, we have transgressed this and this. So, this is more of a moral appeal that please act this way and this way, and not beyond this. Countries do act in a certain way. They do violate these norms, and you cannot drag them to a court. But that does not mean that we have to sit and lie back and not try to put some measures in place that will regulate how we do things. Therefore, you are right. To some extent, it is voluntary. But by the same token, if you have acceded to a treaty, you are morally bound by it. So you are expected to act in the spirit and letter of that treaty. Developing countries versus developed countries' subscription to international legal instruments. You will recall, I said that conflicts, more especially contemporary conflicts, which are intrastate in character, they occur in developing countries. Therefore, they affect us the most, and we are the ones that have more of a direct interest in regulating those type of conflicts. And therefore, it seems very logical that we as developing countries should actually take a lead in not only defining instruments that will regulate those conflicts, but should also strive to be members of those instruments, so that by being members, we are morally bound by those instruments not to get into those type of conflicts. And if we do get into them, at least we conduct them according to specified rules which limit the use of excessively injurious types of weapons. I hope I've covered all the questions raised. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I think let me echo the sentiments of my colleagues and say that the ambassador has certainly made it easy for us to see what is our mandate here. And also appreciate the fact that he has come twice just to come and clarify some of the issues that we have. I think the ambassador also tried to explain the issue of the contraventions, because of, for me, is that if international law is not enforceable or there's no compliance, then it's a futile exercise. And to that, I see there's lots of state parties in your opening preamble about the convention, where we've got lots of them that have signed to be members of the CCW. What is the status quo in terms of contraventions and compliance? And what are those issues? And I would like to raise this second issue. I think it's quite an interesting new phenomenon in international conflict, the role of the military security companies. There's a growing trend of the use of these military security companies, and most of them have got military expertise. Where do they fit in this equation? Do they use restricted weapons or do they use prohibited weapons? I think that comes again another dilemma of restriction and prohibition. So where do they fit in this? And I think it's linked to the issue of the intrastate, because of, I think, the ratification or the accessions that we're talking about, it's about interstate, between states. But the growing trend of intrastate is at the heart of international relations in the modern day global world. So what is the link there, and how can that be filtered through to ensure? Because of, I think most of the intrastate conflict is within the developing world. Just to also emphasize the point of Honorable Magama, you know, in terms of the developing nations. But there is that dilemma of the use of these weapons. So if I can just have your comment on that. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Sundusa. For this month. No, ADT. I want to share the just the last issue from me. Definitely, I would like to concur with my colleague Chair that, and the presentation was very, very simple and very, very understandable, and therefore, and the request at the end of it, I think we need to give maximum support to its approval. The last issue is my interest is around the continent. The role of AU in this, in ensuring and encouraging various countries to participate, and take into consideration what my colleagues have referred to about the continental interests with regard to stability within the continent generally, both intra and interstate.
How do you classify the AK-47? Is it part of small arms or is it a lethal weapon? And then, but let me raise this a serious question. What are the time frames which we're talking about for the required action of the ratification, just to help the committee further, so that we are able to deal with our own timetable as we consider this particular matter? Secondly, have we been forced to deal with our own laws or domestic laws just to do what other people call leveling the playing field for implementation? What else was in my mind? Oh no, that's fine. That's okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Coming to Honorable Makgalapa's comments, I would like to first point out that it is not entirely a futile exercise to subscribe to some of these international legal instruments. If you look at the post-Second World War situation and the role that legal international instruments have played in engendering peace and security, you will realize that the world would have been at a mayhem. Some role players provoked in some instances chose to be bound by some of these instruments rather than get into conflict. So, these instruments have helped in a way in placing restraints on member states, and they have helped where armed conflicts have erupted in at least ensuring that those armed conflicts are not conducted in a manner that is very, very despicable. So I would say it's not really an exercise in futility. But of course, there is this fundamental flaw with the international public law. Now, coming to the issue of consultation and compliance. Again, let me point out here that compliance is an issue of moral obligation. Consultation is provided for in the context of meeting of these parties, which occur annually. That is when we now sit down, kind of get into an honest exercise. How are we faring? What is lacking? What can be reinforced? Those meetings almost assume the character of a review. So, in a way, they provide a very useful platform for both consultation and review of compliance. Coming to the role of military security companies, and how, and where do they fit in the equation? Now, let me say here that if you look at these companies, where do they operate most? They are found in intrastate conflicts, where various interest groups would solicit their services, which becomes difficult, to define and ascribe blame and responsibility for certain actions. Whereas if it's an interstate conflict, one would be wearing the military uniform of country X and the opposing side the military uniform of country Y. So you can distinctly see the parties. But these are very amorphous elements that come in into a situation, disappear into the thin air, and carry out these activities. And they are a serious threat to international peace and security. Most unfortunately, the international community has not risen to the challenge of addressing the implications of these companies in armed conflict. There is yet no instrument that regulates their activities, and there has not been yet an occasion to seriously discuss this, the role of these entities. What we have done as South Africa in 2007, in 2008, when we were members, non-permanent members of the Security Council, we initiated a discussion in the Security Council on security sector reform, which touches in a way on the role of these entities, because they are part and parcel of the security sector. We wanted, through this agenda item, to start gaining the attention of the international community on this matter so that we start addressing it. And we will pursue this again when we go back to the Security Council now. This is one of the unfinished businesses we would like to pursue. And we hope we will achieve something. But also let me hasten to point out that there are very, very huge interest groups that these security companies represent. They are more or less now, in my assessment, trying to parallel the role of defense industry. You know, because they have to peddle certain goods. And those goods are attractive to certain industries. So we hope that at some point there will be a discussion on this. Honorable Smart Ngonyama, thank you for the support and I hope you are speaking on behalf of the other honorable MPs, even if you have democratically not consulted them. But I hope you represent their aspirations. On the role of the African Union, let me point out here that as South Africa, we have played a prominent role in trying to put this matter on the agenda of the AU. The AU has what is called the Peace and Security Council. This is the body we are trying to utilize, that it focuses on some of these issues in an effective and robust manner. It is not easy because there are other pending issues. You have Somalia, you have Darfur, you know, which require urgent and serious attention. But we are trying, by all means, to utilize the AU to start playing a proactive role in relationship to these issues. You know that the AU has just been reformed, and whatever is new and new ideas are always taken with caution. But nonetheless, we are trying to influence some forward movement and active involvement by the AU on such matters. The fact that South Africa, during its tenure in 2007 and 2008 at the Security Council, it tried to foster a good working relationship between the United Nations Security Council and the AU, I think is a demonstration of how we are also trying to make sure that they are effective partnerships, because the African continent lacks the resources to effectively play a role in regard to this kind of mandate. Honorable Mercy, about time frames required, I would say it's yesterday. We are a bit behind. We are a significant player in the context of the South on these matters. If South Africa is not active, some people also draw back. If South Africa is not active, the bridge-building role between the North and the South in terms of differences is absent. If South Africa is not active, the wherewithal to effect effective partnerships is again absent. So, I would say we ought to have acted like yesterday, but tomorrow is still time to act. We are still going to meet in Geneva before the end of the year, so the goal can still be achieved. With regard to our own national laws, before coming here, DICO sought the legal opinion of the Chief State Law Advisor if consenting to Article 1 and Additional Protocol 5 would not be in conflict with our national laws. And the Chief Law State Advisor advised that this would not be in conflict. So we would be acting in conformity with our laws. And I must point out that already on some of the aspects of the additional protocol 5, we are already acting and in a manner as if we are morally obliged. The defense force is exercising restraint. Some of the mines have been kept behind only for training purposes and all that. And we are actively participating in demining and clearance assistance wherever possible. So we are in line. I thank you.
Can I just also say nothing? I think I won't let the security company back. I'm going to say this out. I'm going to say this out.
No, but on a serious note, maybe in another committee or in another forum, this question of security companies is a very serious matter. I mean, ADT is deeply rooted in South Africa, and it's a foreign company. It's an American company. It's deeply rooted. As an example, Honorable Mogo. But that might be for another forum, but it's something which concerned or all honorable members must think about. It's a serious security issue, this one. You want to raise the last issue? I just want to...
No, Chair, just add on to just what was just said about security. According to certain estimates, actually, the private security outnumbers our police force by far. That if all the security companies would be mobilized, they could overrun our own police. So it's very, very serious that to what extent, because if you look at even the ownership of those companies, the majority of those are owned by former generals in the apartheid army. But that's a subject for another day. Thank you, Chair.
I'm tempted to add a last question.
to the ambassador. I'm just reminded about these Somali pirates. And their impact in the continent with regard to economic development, and how serious is AU taking that element or entity and that is operating within our sea as a continent within this context? Because it's a very, very serious issue, this. And they just continue to operate, and you don't hear anything that is coming very seriously from AU and calling and some kind of a measure of curbing this, and they just continue on their own. I was just tempted to ask that question. Thank you.
No, you're right.
Thanks, Chair. That was the point, actually, that I forgot, these private security companies. Now, Chair, I think at some point we might have to ask for a briefing. Because you see, it look, for instance, I know some countries are using these private security companies as an element of how they conduct their foreign policy. You see? You take, for instance, the role they play in Iraq currently. They are a tool of how they pursue their foreign policy, and you go to the Halliburton scandals and so on and so on, and you find that this is very much. Now, I know a couple of years ago, there was an attempt by our government to curtail the role that South Africans play in foreign conflicts, and in fact, there was a piece of legislation promulgated in that regard. Now, Chair, these private security companies are very much active in our own country, very much. And in my view, have the potential to undermine, our foreign policy. or implementation or effectiveness or outcome of our foreign policy. And I think in that context, we need to get a briefing to say, but what is the feature of this private security, of this, I mean, what content and character, is our own, is this problem in our own country, insofar as, its involvement in affairs of other countries is concerned. I think we need such a briefing. I'm sure DICO will know who to call to assist with such a briefing, because it's not necessarily their own, field of speciality, but they work with the relevant people on a daily basis. They will know what to do. Thanks.
No, you're right. You see, in the context of, remember, what happened in Zimbabwe and the, what is it, was it Guinea?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We might have an entry to this particular debate.
Mm-hmm.
You are the last honorable there.
Sure.
Mohalab.
Thanks, Chair. I think I'm glad that I've raised this debate of the role of the military security companies. But I think we just definitely have to have the briefing. I support the call that we have that briefing, because of, I think there's a big growing trend, and it's more bigger than we even think. Your ADTs of this world, they are just a small fish in the ocean. We're talking about big military security companies. And the evolution is from mercenaries to military security companies. So actually, it's in a way trying to formalize and legalize mercenaries in some other form. There is a report from Geneva about this as well, and I think perhaps the department would know about it. I think there's about $500 million that is being invested alone in Iraq based on this military security company. So it's a very big issue that is coming, and I'm glad that the department will take it up at the Security Council. But maybe we need to preempt that and make sure that they've got a bigger mandate and have a briefing on that and take a resolution to that effect. So I do support the call for a briefing about it.
You see, this is music in my ears. Because the source of this thing is the privatization of services. That's the source of the whole. That's the evil. You see, this liberalization of wanting to privatize everything, including security.
Okay.
No. We'll deal with that later on. unless Ambassador Kung, you want to make a last comment.
If I may, Chairperson, I would just like to point out that the issue of pirates and the AU, most unfortunately, did not receive attention and continues not to receive attention, largely because of the origins of the pirates. The area where they originate from, there is no entity, legal entity, or organized entity in the form of a state, or so you can appeal to say, look, please exercise restraint. Somalia is a failed state. Whom do you talk to exercise control over those Somali nationals that are involved in piracy? So it becomes a difficult task for the AU. What I know has happened in Kampala at the last summit was that there were talks to say, South Africa, you should start playing a role vis-a-vis the conflict in Somalia. And that secondly, you should look at some countries like the US has, for instance, said, South Africa, you should look at providing facilities to detain and prosecute those pirates that we capture in the high seas. Now, this is a huge responsibility. I don't understand why, if you have captured somebody, you should give to the other country. When it comes to Taliban and all that, they capture them and take them to their own facilities. But when it comes to these pirates, now South Africa must take them in. I don't understand the logic in that. So there are still those problems. What I know is that the Justice, Peace and Security cluster is also looking at this matter as to what they will find at the end and recommendations they'll make. I don't know. It's an issue and work in progress. But clearly, the AU has not, in my assessment, actively addressed this matter. Largely also due to capacity. You know, there is no capacity really to monitor these people in the high seas, capture them, and if they were to be captured, where do you take them? Under which laws do you try them? I do agree with the need of a briefing on private security companies. Some time ago, there were attempts internationally to try and curtail the role of mercenaries. But that debate kind of died down. Again, I think because of the amorphous nature of these people and because of the huge monies involved. So there was lack of interest to take the matter further. But I think it would be appropriate to look into this. And also that DICO, if we succeed in being re-elected into the Security Council, we continue keeping focus on this matter when we get back to the Security Council. Thank you.
Let me summarize by first thanking War Ambassador Kumbi. For me, this was music as I was listening to this briefing. You see, Honorable Mkhalapa and Putismat, majority of deployed cadres do not disappoint us when they present, you see. Yes. So deployed cadres would not disappoint you when they present on these issues.
That's a political statement.
No. On a serious note, Ambassador, thank you very much. The way you have presented yourself on this subject, I think there's a clear understanding now from all the members. In fact, I suspect it was I'm not sure whether it was Honorable Mkhalapa who preempted even the outcome of this meeting. We're very clear in moving towards a certain approval now, given how things have been clarified to us, which then suggests that we will go and prepare a formal resolution. Because we are in agreement that we need to approve this, ratify whatever. We'll prepare a formal resolution which we will table in the meeting next week. However, we should ask the members if
or whether they have any concerns or other recommendations which must accompany this particular approval. So that draft resolution or report will be ready to be tabled in the House, but will come with the DFS. There's one particular recommendation which is arising out of this presentation. The briefing on the security companies and the implications thereof. We will try and do some coordination with the others who are affected, because it's not only DICO. There will be others, but it's still within the security cluster. Call it peace and security cluster. But we will come back to you, DICO. We will be working with you on this matter. Who would be the other stakeholders on this particular matter? But it's certainly, we want to put it as one of our recommendations that we will have to look into the role of the security, private security companies. Chief.
Chair, thank you very much. I don't know whether those two are really connected. As a recommendation, I don't think it really touches on this. But I would support what you're saying, that we need to have a briefing on that as a separate topic altogether, probably in conjunction with other committees, like you said, maybe defense and military affairs or something like that. But I think we need to do that. But we should separate this too.
With that, we've come to the end of this item. Thank you once more, Chief. Shall we move into the next item, which is we were to consider the agreement on the TTCA based on the recommendations or the discussions of last week. I just want to check from Honorable Makgao, who was leading the discussions or the committee last week, as to are we ready on this or there is a process which we must first follow to deal with it. Any thinking around that?
Thank you, Chair. I think as the committee, like now, we have agreed last week after the deliberations that in essence we do not have problems with the revision of the TDCA, and we had requested that if possible the route that you have proposed for this CCW, that we have a report before we can finally take the matter to the House be considered. Maybe I will add the last point that if possible, maybe next week we can get some expert advice who can just give us advice on that, on those revisions on the TDCA before we finally submit the report to Parliament. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with my colleague, but I don't recall that we decided that we're going to call for expert advice, because my recollection was that we actually agreed with the recommended amendments, and that we're just going to proceed with the. I'm saying this, Chair, in terms of the limitations of time that we have in this term. As you know, we've got there are other, not for us, but other pieces of legislation that need to be completed. So I think, I don't want us to be under pressure to complete assignments like this by calling other things, because we really did agree in the last meeting, as far as I can remember. Thank you, Chair.
Let me just check. The draft report must come here.
Yes.
Can we agree that draft report comes here? If we feel that there's a particular area we feel strong about, if we feel that there's a particular area that we feel strong about, at that particular time we can just make a motivation, as Honorable Maha would say. Can we agree on that? Thank you. Seeing that there's no other business, and I thank all the honorable members and declare that we are adjourning the meeting now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then we will go into the next session with IDASA. We're going into the next session with IDASA. You all released except Honorable Mahal and the staff members.
Thank you.